Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us on Three Women, Three Ways. We're the show that looks at life, looks at education, looks at things in the news, and we look at it from our perspectives. We have three different perspectives, but we're all kind of tied in together with women's issues and violence issues. So I am Heather Stark, and I am here as one of the three hosts joining us today. And we have a really interesting topic today, I think. But first, let's do the introductions. Connie Sue, you want to go first and tell us who you are?
Sure. This is Connie Sue, or also known as Pinkley. And I'm here this morning after a little bit of a hiatus, a little break from life. I've had some pretty major transitions, which we've sort of talked about in the past about transitions. I come from a background of surviving domestic violence, not once, but twice with the same person years later. So I'm sort of at the heels end of that episode. I got my bachelor's degree in 2007. I am a program director for a local nonprofit sexual assault and domestic violence agency, which I've been doing now for the last 15 years. And it's exciting and rejuvenating to be here this morning with you ladies and our listeners. So I say good morning to everyone. And Deb, how about you?
Well, yes, good morning. What a lovely Saturday. In my area, at least, it is not raining, so I'm excited. And I, too, have some academic history. I have a tagline that describes me. It's I've lived it, I've studied it, and I've worked it. And I'm talking specifically about domestic violence, but over the years that has expanded to the general category of all forms of violence and specifically against women. And I am also a grandma of eight, and I just got back from I love my job because I get to travel, and I just got back from Phoenix where the sun was out and hot, and I enjoyed that. So I'm ready to go today on our show. What's our topic, Heather?
Well, our topic right now is kind of an eclectic one. We're going to talk a little bit about feminism and how feminism impacts us socially, and we're going to get into a little bit of psychological analysis here. We're just going to go all over the board with where that feminism takes us. And why don't we start with you, Connie Sue, because you're going to tell us a definition of feminism.
Well, before we do that, Heather, can you introduce yourself?
Oh,
tell us
I was
about
skip
you.
Over that. Well, I'm Heather Stark, and I am also in Washington State, and it's a great day here. As a matter of fact, I was almost late getting into the studio because I was on the deck listening to all the birds. I have no idea how to identify those birds by call, but it was just so, it was mesmerizing standing out there listening to them all chattering and chittering. But I am basically a student. I've worked in the field of communications for most of my life, both print and radio, TV. And right now I'm taking a little bit of a hiatus from work, and I'm focusing on my dissertation for my PhD in psychology. And hopefully I'll have that done within the next few months, and then I can be Dr. Heather.
Wow.
And, yeah,
Sorry,
hopefully.
Dr. Heather.
So, you know, I keep telling I got a late start on that whole education thing. So I keep telling my kids, they're going to have to put doctor on my tombstone.
There you go. Well, that's very exciting. We certainly have all had some interesting and rewarding opportunities throughout the years because of our personal situations. And it's quite amazing how our roads can take those paths. So
well, what
this
is
morning,
interesting to me is how all three of us went to education to learn more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an interesting connection as well.
Yeah, it is. So,
that's very
on with the show, and Pinkley, feminism.
Feminism.
I know what it means to me, but what does it mean in general?
In general, well, it's coined or cliched as the women's lib movement. It's about liberation, about anti-oppression, and it refers to a series of campaigns or reforms on issues such as reproductive rights, domestic violence, maternity leave, equal pay, women's suffrage, sexual violence, just about women's issues in general. And I think everyone should call themselves a feminist. What do you think about that?
Well, I like that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have women on our lives.
Yeah, before we go too much farther, I do have the chat room open. And we have the call-in number if anybody wants to join our Feminism is Fabulous conversation. That number is 646-378-0430. So go ahead, Connie Sue. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's a great shout-out. I appreciate that very much. So if we all have a basic understanding, I think feminism or being a feminist has sure gotten a bad rap through the years. It has a real negative connotation, and I think that part of my goal this morning would be to ask our listeners to think about this in a different way and reframe it. And every person in our lives has a woman in their life, mother, sister, daughter, aunt, cousin, granddaughter, and we should embrace the term and celebrate it. I know in my upbringing it was sort of a real taboo, negative burn. You get this image of the burning your bra image, and I always thought, wow, I want to wear my bra. I don't know why anybody would want to burn it, but anyway.
They're so expensive.
Yeah. And I have noticed that through the age of time, also the sizes have changed, but for me personally. So that's an interesting phenomenon.
Well, I'd like to read this quote that I found, and it's about women. And it's actually attributed to Joan of Arc. So it says, "One life is all we have, and we live it as we believe in living it. But to sacrifice what you are and to live without belief, that is a fate more terrible than dying." Now, that's attributed to Joan of Arc. And if everybody remembers who she was in France. I don't even know what century she lived, but she was a female warrior, and that was very, very unusual for a woman to be on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was burned to the stake for
it. Yes, feminism is kind of about that, and here's what she's saying is you have to be who you are and live without, you know, and be living it. Know who you are and live it, and then you will feel that kind of And for me, feminist theory is about equality. What do you think, Heather?
I think it's about choices. I think that equality is one of the basic tenets, but it's also about choices. I think that for a while, feminism was seen as only the bra burning and the women who wanted to be in traditional male jobs. But I think it really is about choices, and that a woman should have the same choices of whether or how she wants to work as a man, and to have the opportunities to do so without lower pay.
All right. I like that. Well, here's another quote, and this is attributed to Rebecca West. She says, "I myself have never been able to find out precisely what feminism is. I only know that people call me a feminist whenever I express sentiments that differentiate me from a doormat."
I like that.
So that kind of goes to Connie's, words, where she said it had a pretty negative, connotation. Being called a feminist is not always a positive thing.
Yeah.
Or that you're radical, and that you're, carrying around a sign. I mean, there's lots of images that come to mind, at least in my upbringing, about what feminism is. And I just want to run down this list that I found. It's really interesting. And I actually found it on the website Fourth Wave Feminist. And we'll talk a little bit later about the different waves. But I still think that the root of it is about the ability to be thought of as is an equal person, that women are not second-class citizens. The 10 reasons to embrace the term feminism. 10, women are still paid less. 9, reporters and writers can slam women on TV and print it with impunity. I'm sick of young women growing up believing this is just how it is. No woman has ever won a major party nomination for president. This is, of course, on the Fourth Wave Feminist page. Only 2 women have ever been on a major party ticket as a VP candidate. Institutionalized sexism and women hating defeated Clinton and Palin with women colluding. Women undermine other women more than support them, and that is, I would say, truth-telling in itself. Women are in danger of a rape and attack every time they leave their homes. Beating women, and this is really interesting, beating women is still called domestic violence. Like, that makes it understandable, less appalling than what a similar assault on any other person would be called. That is very interesting. Mm. And number 1, women stick together can do anything.
I like that. Where did you get that?
Pardon me?
Where did you get that, Connie Sue? What's that from?
That's on a website called fourthwavefeminist.wordpress.
Okay. So
uniting and inspiring women.
So WordPress, that's a blog. Is that someone's blog?
It is.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's great points and very telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'm still confused, and I do consider myself a feminist. I'm still confused about the fourth wave. I mean, there's the first, second, third, and fourth that we're in now, but can you just very briefly tell us what those were, what those are?
Well, Deb, you were going to talk about the first, second, and third, and the fourth is really still being defined. Go ahead.
The first wave was around the time of the late 1800s and early 1900s, and it was basically, like Connie Sue said, it was around reform movements. For instance, in the 1800s, women band together for the temperance. They actually got Congress to repeal the sale of liquor, because I think this is so interesting that even though they didn't have the science that we have now, women were able to make a connection between, alcohol use and violence against women, because they realized that their husbands were, like, spending all their money on drink, or they would come home and be abusive to their wives. So women kind of, through religion, organized themselves and got the rest of the United States to see that there was this connection and behavior needed to be changed. So that was really the beginnings. But then as it became identified as a women's movement was in 1848, of course, with women such as Susan B. Anthony, Alice Paul, all those who were working primarily on the legal status of women and the right to vote, because up to that point, women were looked at as property. They had no rights to custody of children in divorce. They really were, they couldn't own property. And so they were really looking at the legal status of women. And that was, of course, culminated in the right to vote, which was ratified August 26, 1920. So we've been able to vote since then. But I found another page that said in the 40s and 50s there was the war helped challenge stereotypes of women, because so many women entered the workplace because the men were sent overseas to fight in World War II. Mm-hmm. And so that had a huge impact on
breaking stereotypes where, you know, you, the Rosie the Riveter poster, and women were doing everything in the United States and had to pick up the, not the slack, but pick up the undone. And that was a really important preempting the 60s and 70s, which Connie Sue, you mentioned, was called the, what'd you call it? Liberation movement. But it actually, you know, all this stuff is predicated by 100 years, 200 years of history.
Right.
And when
You mentioned the World War II thing, and when I first graduated from college, I worked in an office where there was a woman who had a PhD. She was doing kind of a low-level social service work, and she she had a PhD in chemistry, of all things, and during the war, World War II, she had been called into service because of the men in that field were in the war. And she was instrumental in helping to develop certain things. And, you know, she was a big mucky muck. And then she said all of a sudden one day the war was over and they said, okay, go home now because, you know, the men are coming back, so we don't need you anymore.
Right.
And that happened.
And she was quite resentful. She was quite resentful of that for her whole life, obviously, and said that, you know, they used her, they wanted her, they found her, you know, quite an asset, but then as soon as a man came back, boom, it went to the man.
Right. I think that
there's a lot of conversation and history around the actual waves, and I think that just in a simplistic, and it's never ever that simple, but the first wave refers to mainly, as Deborah was saying, the women's suffrage movement. Second wave was considered the 1960s to 80s, and was basically the main concern and issue was with gender equality and laws and culture.
Mm-hmm.
The third was started in the early 1990s, a movement now termed the third wave feminism, arose in response to the perceived failures of the second wave feminism. So there could be a lot of controversy just around that. But some of the, like bell hooks, Audre Lorde, feminist women of color, called for a new subjectivity and a feminist voice. So that kind of breaks it down into the one, two, and three. And so then there, of course, is the...
Can I interject before you go into the fourth? I know that the third wave, or sometimes referred to as postmodern, raising the voices of women of color or anybody who didn't identify as Caucasian. But the black women in the U.S. kind of developed their own form, and they called it womanist. They decided they were going to be grounded in their lives as women. And, it's kind of like an offshoot of feminism, but it was much more inclusive and more culture accepting and developed, I think. So I think that's interesting, too, that there was a group of people who defined themselves as womanists.
Womanists. Yeah, wow.
I like that.
So tell us about the fourth.
Well, the fourth is, redefining the fourth. It basically is... It remains really undefined. What does it look like? It embodies contradictory images that emerged during previous waves. So it's sort of redefining and trying to get rid of those negative stereotypes. And also it's really talking about the gender issues as far as people who identify as being feminist but may not be entirely embodied in a female body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're talking about people who may choose to identify as transgendered or...
But or, it's not even really about that. It's
not necessarily agree to a gender by you know, it's not just two genders. They're saying there's more than there's more to gender than just your biological body anyway.
Right.
But they're kind of focusing on that as to it's about who I am, not how I look or how other people perceive me. I think that's kind of where they're going with that.
Right. But that's not
so
entirely. That's
we're
not entirely,
in that fourth wave right now?
Yes, but
yeah.
We're not. It's not entirely just focused on that. It's still sort of yet being defined. And I heard about the fourth wave when I was doing my bachelor work, and it was really quite interesting. And people don't really. I think there's a lot of confusion still around it, and it's probably like history. It's not really going to be defined until history runs its course on whatever it is.
So we have time to look back and analyze
right.
it, right?
And then, so I think it's still, yeah, exactly. So it's still being gelled. And I think that what it's trying to do is encompass and honor the different waves. And I think just for me, what I've discovered in this process of researching this, it's the waves are really through the process of history, taking a chunk of time of history, identifying issues and focusing on these major issues of the time, and then moving forward and going, okay, well, we've addressed this. There's always those encompassing issues of still about equality. We have the right to vote, right? That's been there for a long time, but there are still pressing issues that still in this era need to be addressed. Violence against women, oppression, gender inequality, the recognition of people who identify as women but are not in a male or in a female body or entirely. So what I'm getting out of this is that it's yet to be defined, really.
Yeah.
Good to know that we have room to evolve, right?
But at the same time, I'm finding a lot of young women, don't identify as feminists. They see it as something negative. So isn't that interesting that we're actually in a fourth wave of feminism, but a lot of our young people don't, you know, they're not interested in feminism at all, even the young women.
I would say to Heather and Deb that, too, as a young woman, I was not interested. I mean, it was, it carried a very negative connotation. And until you really understand the term and the theory behind it, then your light bulbs kind of go off and go, oh, yeah, I get that. So to me, what that tells me is that it still carries this very negative stigma. And the younger women of today, the generation today, they're living in the privileges or the work, and maybe privilege isn't the right term because they're the equalities. Maybe that's a better term. The equalities of our movement of feminism.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact of, you know, how much of life you've lived. Now, when I was 20, I didn't have the level of work experience that I had in my 40s.
Sure.
By the time I was 40, I had experienced workplace,
discrimination.
Discrimination. I had been told, you're a woman, you need to stay in your place. In many different ways, some subtle and not so subtle. I had been told a lot of times that you don't qualify for this because, you know, you're just going to go home, you're going to quit and go home and have a baby, so we don't want to hire you for these positions. Those are things that you don't know about until you've experienced it. And I think that
You know, there's a, I think it's a Chinese proverb that says we stand on the shoulders of the people before us or the women before us. And you don't know you're standing on someone's shoulder until you have some time to reflect backwards. So I don't know if it's I think it's just a living and experience thing that we get kind of. And some younger women and men, because we've been finding a lot of men who identify as pro-feminists, and they discover it through an experience when they were younger. Maybe they were raised by a single female parent, you know, or they lived in a poverty, or they had some other kind of condition that helped them experience what you talked about, kind of some of that oppression maybe, or discrimination. And once you've experienced it, then you can say, oh, I get it now. I get what feminism is about.
Well, a lot of the things that I hear from people about feminism not being needed, being an outdated concept right now, is because there have been so many strides made. Young women today, you know, can be a firefighter if they want. When I was a young girl, you couldn't possibly be a firefighter, and if they actually hired you because of a quota or something, they made your life hellish until you quit. And then they said, see, she quit, therefore we were right that women aren't good for this job. So now, you know, I mean, the what is that, Title IX with the sports? You know, when I was a girl again in school, no funding went to women's sports. There wasn't such a thing. It was gym class, and that was it. So there have been so many strides made that sometimes I think younger people who haven't seen what came before don't realize why it's necessary or why it was necessary to even develop the concept of feminism, because ostensibly, at least on the surface, they have all sorts of choices that didn't exist for previous generations. So.
Right, exactly. I agree with that.
Well, but you know, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to, finish your comment, because I was going to segue into something else.
Oh, okay. I was just thinking that, you know, we're talking about this fourth wave and what it's going to be identified with, but I think it has moved to a bigger place of oppression. And, I mean, early in the feminist movement, we talked about patriarchy, and that got a lot of people upset, as if saying that someone has rights or privilege that you don't have is a negative, you know, and that there's fear there that something they have is going to be taken away from them, and we call that privilege, right?
Yes.
So I think we are in our current life, you know, wherever we are in our history, is that, yes, we have incredible access to things that were not possible in the 40s and the 20s. And all of that. I think that makes a big deal of difference.
Yeah. Well, just birth control choices.
Yes.
You know, that's huge. That's kind of like a pivotal point when it comes to feminism, is the choice of whether or not you're going to have a baby. Well, you know, one of the things that I always think of whenever a topic like this comes up is this wonderful book. I actually read it in the 70s or 80s. And I don't remember the authors, but it's called For Her Own Good. And when I first picked it up, it was called subtitled 100 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. I decided a few years ago that I wanted to pick up another copy, so I went on Amazon, and now it's called 150 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. So time marches on. But it was a wonderful book because it talked all about the social implications of feminism. For example, during the late 1800s, very high infant mortality rate. And so that's where the term wet nurse came in. They would literally take, you know, the higher class women or the middle class women who could afford to do so would actually have their babies taken away and given to a wet nurse, which was referral for somebody else to nurse that baby. And one of the reasons that they did that is because the mortality rate was so high they felt it was important for the mother to not become too attached to the child. So for maybe the first, you know, year or two of a child's life, it was basically in the care of someone else and then given back. If it lived that long, then it was given back to the family to raise. And supposedly, a woman who didn't like that arrangement, there was something wrong with her. She was overly attached to that child. Well, then, you know, same thing like with psychological issues and economic issues. And, you know, it was all, you know, women shouldn't work. You know, no, that's taking jobs from a man, blah, blah, blah. And then we have a war. And, hey, woman, you know, come in here and work.
Yeah, but even prior to women shouldn't work, it was women were too weak to work.
Oh, yeah.
And women were too delicate to nurse a child and regain their health, you know, it was a toll on everybody's health. So, I mean, that was a huge switcheroo in perspectives, too.
Well, there was, back in the late 1800s, there was even a big, huge discussion that went on for a decade or more about whether or not women had souls. We knew that white men had souls. We knew that dogs did not have souls. But what about women? Huge, you know, huge intellectual discussions about whether or not a woman could possess a soul. They also had what they called the theory of economies, which was about energy, that you only have so much energy in your body, and a woman needs to focus all that energy on her uterus so she can reproduce and be a natural woman. And if she takes that energy away from her uterus to go to her brain, you know, that's not a good thing. That's just not good at all. And so that whole theory of the, you know, economy of energies, they called it. So any energy that you took away from your uterus, not so good, ladies, you know. So you just kind of want to sit there being a pod, you know, in case you got pregnant. But we did, of course, make some strides against with that, but you know, with this whole idea of, you know, the experts' advice to women, basically the advice of the experts was dependent upon the social and economic environment at the time.
Yeah.
So it sounded
if
like
you
want to
go
women.
If you want to go far back in history, women have been tortured and killed and ostracized for being human. You know, what about the witch dunkings in early U.S. history?
Well, you don't have to go back that far. Look at what happens to rape victims in India right now.
Absolutely. Well, what happens in the United States? They get blamed for their own rape.
Yep.
You know.
Yep. Yeah,
or they get
right
attributed,
so much...
you consented because you were wearing a short skirt or something like that. You
or
know?
What were you doing in that neck of the woods? Or what were you doing, you know, riding with two men alone? You know, I mean, yeah, it's always her fault. You know, it's always her fault for some reason or other. But I would recommend this book if you can find it. I don't know if it's still in print. It might not be. But, you know, really fascinating, the tie-in between, you know, feminism and feminist theory and the social and economic conditions at the time and how all of those supposed requirements for females changed when society needed it to change. You know?
Yeah.
Very fascinating to me. And the other thing that's fascinating to me, maybe we can segue into this, of course, working on a psychology degree, they have these things called theories of psychology. And just briefly, like if you go back and I guess we look at Freudian psychology as, you know, one of the grandfathers of the whole psychological movement, the whole psychological industry. And we look at Freud. Well, Freud thought everything was based on sex, you know. Well, then, you know, in other words, you know, biological focus of how people behave. So you don't behave because you thought this out. You behave because your mother didn't breastfeed you long enough or you had penis envy or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And for a long time, that psychoanalysis kind of theory continued. And then as the field changed, the different theories changed. And so then they went to that, from Freud to that unconscious mental processes, the psychoanalytic. And then they went to a thing called behaviorism and cognitive, which means that your mental processes, you know, previous learning and all that, that you were actually were thinking about something, and that's why you behaved in a certain way. Then they came up with the humanistic and sociocultural theories, which means that, wait a minute, you're not living in a vacuum. You are also part of a social and cultural environment. So maybe that's influencing behavior. And then back in the 70s, they developed feminist theory. And
wow.
Feminist theory not only focuses on, you know, what forces influence both men's and women's behavior, it also looks at special conditions that influence women's behavior, the political, the economic, social rights, and how those forces impact female behavior. And so that kind of ties us in with that whole, you know, book that I was talking about. So any thoughts on that, ladies? No.
Well, I think
I'm taking that all in, Heather.
Okay, next topic.
No.
That is a lot of good information, and the fact that, you know, that our scientists are starting to recognize that there's another way to analyze data and behavior other than the Western unbiased. You know, if you have an interest in something, that you're going to have a biased viewpoint. And I think this kind of move is taking us to where, which women have known all along instinctively, is that we cannot be completely separated from anything that is part of our life. And that sometimes that bias is important in the way we look at the world. You know, maybe women's ways of knowing has always included their actual experience as living. And usually in connection and relationship to other people. So when you look at the Western scientific methodology, where it says you if you do that, you're biased and you have a flawed analysis, you know. So I think it's really important that they have at least acknowledged that there's feminist theories in research and in practice, and that they have value and meaning to the, you know, to the body of science. I think that's important.
Well, I think it's important also because these theories are the foundation for treatments. And throughout history, women have been seen, you know, the measuring stick was male behavior.
Yes.
And anything that varied from that male behavior was deviant or sick. So that left a lot of women defined as being sick.
Other.
These theories also influence treatment and how a woman is treated in psychological situations and even mental health and physical health situations.
Yeah.
Well, I think that what my takeaway from this, Heather, is that it's sort of like our medical field. You know, they would treat only the medical ailment or symptom or make some sort of assumption that it's all in your head if they couldn't find anything physically, but yet your body was reacting in a physical way with a symptom. And that we're trying to look holistically and understanding that everything is interconnected, your mind, your body, your spirit. Oh, yeah, that's right. We don't have a spirit, but now we do.
No, you can be spiritual. Yeah.
Oh, you can be spiritual. Okay. Well, you get my point on it, thoughts about realizing or understanding that your life experiences, your nurture or your nature, how you were brought up, the traumas, the impact of your levels of how you survive in the world, whether you're you were brought up in poverty or not, all of those things play an important role in who we become and who we are and how we process and see the world and how we even interact with other people. So it's and most of the movement of psychology, starting with, you know, Jung, were mostly males. There weren't females in this mix of trying to understand the human psyche.
Well, they were there, but they were not acknowledged, and they were not given credit for the work they did. I think they were there.
Early on, following Freud, there was a female psychologist who came up with the idea. You know, Freud was famous for his, you know, penis envy theory, and she actually came up with uterus envy, saying that it was actually men who are jealous or envious of women because they could actually create life. Whereas men can't. So, as opposed to Freud, who thought women would aspire to be men, she came up with this theory that no, it was actually the men who were envious of the women. So it was uterus envy.
I can follow that. I think that has been the basis for a lot of persecution of being a female over the past hundreds of years, is that men didn't understand how women could reproduce, so they tried to suppress it. You know?
Well, I think they were afraid of it.
Afraid of it, and they tried to suppress it, yes.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They couldn't figure it out, they couldn't totally control it, so they wanted to get rid of it.
Well, and I do believe there was something that is this, you know, this is one of my personal little off-the-wall theories. You know how different cultures have had coming-of-age rituals for young boys? Usually involving either circumcision or hunting and killing an animal, or, you know, some sort of marker that they had turned an adult, usually involving blood. Okay? And what do we consider a girl turning into womanhood? When the menses begin. Menses are blood. So I have this little off-the-wall theory. I've never heard anybody else say this, that a lot of these male coming-of-age rituals are based on envy for the female menses.
That's interesting. I think that people that might argue that, but it's an interesting thought, Heather. I like it. I think
a
lot of male coming of age rituals were designed around, I'm talking, you know, several hundred years ago when the men were the hunters and had to learn some skills that maybe were not so much innate or intuitional. So that's kind of what I think about that. But I appreciate your sharing that. I think, you know, this is how we process things and this is how things get learned. And I think feminist participatory research has a real use and benefit in any kind of research, because you're working with the people who have been most impacted by whatever situation or concern you're working on. And that kind of falls into my love of this thing called popular education, my feminism ideas and my interdisciplinary studies, because I try never to look at things in the world through one lens. I always try to see what is the other side of that story, or how do other people view it, and then that's called interdisciplinary views. And that's kind of continuing to grow area for academia as well, interdisciplinary studies.
Yeah, I think that whole area of education right now is quite fascinating. You know, how much of it, how many universities have made their courses available for free to people. You don't get the degree, of course, you still have to buy that. But the whole idea of education being accessible
Yeah.
You know,
I'm taking an online course right now from Stanford in California on public health. So it's a 7-week course. It's totally free.
Ah, wonderful.
And I've done that in the past, too. And you're right. I think it is good that we're finding ways to make it accessible to people.
Okay.
Well, Connie,
that back into feminism. Does that have any connection to our feminism and our fourth wave?
I think it does, because we're trying to go beyond our the one and only white male view. I think we're trying to expand people's thought processes and understanding the world beyond the white male view. And I think that's really important. And that could, I mean, for there are so many things that aren't written into history. You know, like for my granddaughters, they don't learn about women leaders in their elementary education. That's really left up to me. I'm always telling them about different women and, you know, like telling my little 5-year-old granddaughter, you're going to be a president someday, aren't you? You know, nobody does things like that, but we always do it with our male children. You know, we assume our male children will rise to these high leadership positions, but girls don't have that same example, although it is improving.
Do you have that book, The Uppity Women series?
No, I don't.
They have a whole series of books called Uppity Women of the New World, or Uppity Women of Shakespearean Times. And what the series does is it talks about women who are of historical significance or social significance during those particular eras. And they're really quite good. I mean, I went through them, and, boy, a lot of these women I'd never even heard of.
Yeah.
So I recommend
for me as you know, being female-bodied, I find it very intriguing and interesting to learn about the lives of women in the past as well as the lives of men. I don't say I don't want to hear, you know, what's in the history books. I just want to know some more about it. I want to know deeper than just the war heroes, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, especially for your granddaughter, I would go to the library and get some of the Uppity Women books. And I think they're written by Vicki Leon, L-E-O-N. Yeah, that's the author, Vicki Leon, L-E-O-N.
Okay.
And there's a whole series of Uppity Women, and you can learn all about all sorts of women that you haven't heard of before. And
wow.
There's also a book called Women War Heroes, and that's by George and Anne Forty, F-O-R-T-Y. See, I have a bunch of these books, so.
Well, and you can go to the National Women's History Project website, and, of course, they have tons of information. And they do also have free curriculum for instructors who want to, you know, incorporate and bring that into what is mandated, of course, by the regulators. But there's all sorts of ways. But Heather and I attended a class at the University of Colorado, Denver, and I got a handout that I have kept since then, and it's called The Principles of Feminism. And there's 13 of them. I was just wondering if we wanted to go through some of those and kind of talk about it.
I'd love to.
And see how you girls feel about them.
Sure.
The first principle is to assert our value as women in a society that too often undervalues our worth, contributions, and experiences. What do you think about that? Do we need to assert our value?
I think so. I like that that statement, because in the past, in our conversation this morning, we've been talking about, you know, what does feminism mean, and we've talked about equality, and we've talked about opportunity and choices, but we actually didn't talk about asserting our values.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Pinkley, you have any comments on that one?
Well, I agree. I think that our values are deeply seated within us, and we operate unconsciously through our value system. And I think that as we get older and mature and life experiences, some of our values change or are challenged by having more knowledge and information, and especially embracing the word feminism.
Yeah.
And not seeing that as a dirty word or a,
and not seeing that as being negative, absolutely. And it's taken me a long time to really understand truly the meaning of what feminism is. And I think that once I took it from the context of this is not, it's about women, but it's not about women versus men. It's about honoring who women are, and all people should identify as being a feminist. We are people.
Yeah. Right. So here's another one. The role to be a feminist, we need to question the institution of family as it's currently structured, and to challenge the roles and responsibilities of women and men in family caregiving.
And again, I think that our times have changed. And look at the current TV hit series, Modern Family. I don't know if either one of you have watched that. I don't watch it on a regular basis. But that, and it's if you think about social media or media, that is infiltrated through our living rooms, and then we become more accepting of different standards or different sets of what family means.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that that in looking at the current movement of changing state laws to authorize or acknowledge gay and lesbian marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely questioning the institution of family as it's currently structured. And it's also challenging the roles and responsibility of men and women in family caregiving. I mean, I say it about one of my sons all the time. I say he gets to be Mr. Mom or things like that, because it still is unusual for men to be the primary caregiver in a family.
Well, do you see that as any kind of a problem?
No, because I think it's perfect, and I think it should be that way all along. I could have used some help from the children when they were growing up.
Wouldn't it have been nice? Yeah.
Oh, so well, I'm very happy for him to have that kind of experience, because a lot of men, by not participating in family caregiving, are really shortchanging themselves of some really meaningful moments of relationship with their own family, whether it's their children or elders, whatever, however your family is. I think that men are really shortchanging themselves by not participating in that. So I think it's
I think you're right. I think you're right.
Okay, so there's some other ones here. And we just kind of talked about this. But to be a feminist is to recognize, include, and value women's different kinds of knowledge, including knowledge informed by personal experience and knowledge acquired through work and education. So we kind of talked a little bit about that. I have a book called Women's Way of Knowing, and this is exactly what that whole book is talking about, and how that puts you inside the experience and kind of changes the whole analysis, because you are actually in it, not outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because again, you know, I'm so focused on research right now because of what I'm doing, and there are two ways that you can do a study that you can analyze something, and one way is called quantitative, and that's the way, you know, where we always find the 90% of men are going to go bald or whatever. I mean, I just made that up. But that's called quantitative. It's actual numbers involved in the research. And that's the way the research has always been done. And in the last 25 years or so, they've come up with qualitative studies, which involve smaller numbers of people and really analyzing and meeting with them and, you know, getting their story and using that story, those stories, as a basis for research. And, again, I've never heard anybody say this, but I see this as more of an influence of feminism, because that qualitative approach is so much more feminist and so much more of a female approach than the traditional quantitative, analyze number, assign numbers to everything, and then analyze it. And
it gives you a value for your life experience, whereas the quantitative is to be unbiased. You must be outside the hypotheses looking in. You cannot be a part of that or use your own personal experience or anything, because that ruins the result. But I think that this different way that, you know, qualitative and feminist participatory research kind of changes that and makes it a much richer knowledge, because you have more than just a number on a paper. You know, you can actually see it at work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, and most people, you know, most of the researchers and educators that I know consider qualitative just as important as quantitative at this point. There are a few holdouts that say you have to have those numbers or it doesn't mean anything, you know. But I see that as a feminist influence.
Yeah, I think so too. So I think that to be a feminist is more than just burning your bra, right?
Yeah.
Actually, I read somewhere that nobody actually ever burned a bra.
Is that right?
I think they had pictures of it. It was maybe once. And I think it was in California, and it might have, it was on a campus where, you know, in the late 60s and 70s, campuses were just these hotbeds of of revolutionary things. But I do think it did happen, but maybe only once. And it became the symbol of, you know, a really deep and committed theory and practice that is really not appropriate.
Yeah. Well, I also think it trivialized the movement, you know. It really did. You know, you just kind of sum up an entire movement with, oh, they don't want to be confined by a bra, so they burned it. You know, I mean, please.
Yeah.
Funny suit,
some of us really like our bras.
Yeah. And they're so expensive. That's what gets me. We've gone round and round and around, but what we haven't talked about is the future of feminism.
Well, I think Connie was addressing that with our fourth wave, don't you think, Heather?
Well, it could be. What do you think, Connie? Do you think that whole issue of the fourth wave?
Well, I think that we're just in – it's kind of an exciting time to just see what happens. It's like Deb was talking about, just as an example, I mean, embracing the idea of a stay-at-home dad, the modern family, what does that look like? It's not the traditional or the so-called valued only in the male and female. I just think that it's an exciting time that we're still in the process of change. And isn't that really what it's all about, is the constant change of life? And I think through the waves of feminism, I think just by doing some of this research on my own this morning and sharing it and having this beautiful conversation with you ladies, is that their eras, really the waves are the eras of the history of, or herstory, of how women have changed our world, and that we are here living in some of the privileges of those changes, really. I mean, there's lots of women that take voting for granted. That's just one example. So I don't know so much. What are your thoughts, Heather?
Well, you know, I think that feminism is based on the culture. And our culture is changing so much. that I just think that the whole concept of feminism, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where if you do your job right, you won't need it. Mm-hmm. If we actually, you know, come up with this equality and this idealism, we won't need a feminist movement anymore. That's my thought.
Yeah. Hey, Deb, how about a quote? We're just about out of time, it looks like.
Well, yes, we couldn't close a conversation on feminism without including the voice of Gloria Steinem. And here's her quote. A feminist, anyone who recognizes the equality and full humanity of women and men. And I think that sums it up for me. How about you?
Absolutely.
It sums it up for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, audience. We are three women.
Three ways.
Three divas.
Awesome.
Thanks for listening.
Have a good day.